CNAS Live is back. If you've listened before, welcome back. If you're new to this series, we're bringing you some of the best events from the Center for New American Security in an audio format. Either way, thanks for joining us. Let's get into our latest episode. Last week, the White House released an executive order detailing a ban on U.S. private equity and venture capital investments in some Chinese technology companies that have potential military applications. The investment restrictions come through a series of outbound investment mechanisms that notably affect chips, quantum, and AI. To break down the executive order and discuss what's in, what's out, and what it all means for investors in U.S. companies, CNAS hosted a special event with the Atlantic Council's Geoeconomic Center. The conversation was moderated by Emily Kilcrease, Senior Fellow and Director of the Energy Economics and Security Program at CNAS. She was joined by Sarah Bowerly Dansman, Senior Fellow at the Atlantic Council, Peter Harrell, Non-Resident Fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and Eric Sayers, Managing Director at Beacon Global Industries. Head to cnas.org/events to watch the full video, or check out previous events and register for upcoming ones. Here's their conversation. Good morning, everyone. Welcome to this morning's event. My name is Emily Kilcrease. I'm the Senior Fellow and Director of the Energy Economics and Security Program at the Center for a New American Security. Really delighted to be hosting today's event with a fantastic panel of speakers. And I'll also note that we are co-hosting this event in partnership between the Center for a New American Security and the Atlantic Council. So thank you everyone for joining us on very short notice. We know there's a lot of interest in the question of outbound investment, a lot of interest in unpacking exactly what the executive order says, doesn't say, where there's still some confusion. We're really looking forward to a lively and robust conversation this morning. We are lucky to be joined by a fantastic panel of speakers who all have been thinking hard about the question of outbound investment for many years now, we could even say. So let me introduce our panel, then we'll get into the conversation. First, I'd like to introduce Sarah Bowerly Dansman. Sarah is an associate professor at the University of Indiana, a senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She previously worked at the U.S. Department of State as a policy advisor in the Office of Investment Affairs. She's a renowned expert on the political economy of international investment and finance, and of course, most importantly, co-author of our report, Sand in the Silicon, Designing an Outbound Investment Mechanism, that was jointly published last year by CNAS and the Atlantic Council. We're also really delighted to have Peter Harrell. Peter is a non-resident fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's serving currently in his private capacity as an attorney advising companies and investors on geopolitical risks. And of course, as many of you will know, he previously served in the White House as Senior Director for International Economics and Competitiveness, and has spent a lot of time in that capacity thinking about and working on the Outbound Investments Executive Order. So welcome, Peter. And then last but certainly not least, we're delighted to be joined by Eric Sayers. Eric is Managing Director at Beacon Global Strategies, non-resident fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, where he focuses on Asia-Pacific defense policy and strategy and U.S.-China tech policy, and previously served as Special Assistant to the Commander at U.S. PACOM and a staff member with the majority staff of the Senate Armed Services Committee. So couldn't ask for a better group to talk about this executive order with. And I want to thank all three of them for making time on an August Friday morning afternoon, very short notice. I know we've all been eagerly anticipating the release of this executive order. And so it's great to be able to get together and start talking about what this all means. We want to take the conversation today in three main parts. So we're going to spend a little bit of time initially just setting the stage. How did we get to this moment in the policy conversation? What is the administration seeking to achieve with the executive order? What are the policy objectives that they're really trying to get at here? We'll then spend a bit of time getting into the details, and there are a lot of details to unpack. If folks haven't read the full AMPRM, I highly recommend that you do so. We'll be getting into some of those weeds today. And then we do want to spend some time talking about what's next. Obviously, Congress has views on this issue. We expect there to be a robust debate. There will be continued conversations with partners and allies overseas. And of course, China's response as well. And so we'll get into all of that. We are very much hoping to have a lively conversation with the audience as well. So if you would like to pose a question or a comment, You may do so by joining the chat function on the webpage, or you can do so on Twitter or whatever we're calling Twitter these days as well. And we are looking forward to getting to those questions throughout the conversation. We're not going to just hold that to the end. So if you've got a burning question, please go ahead and start dumping those into the chat function or on Twitter, and we will integrate those throughout. So that's enough out of me. Why don't we get into the conversation? Peter, I'm going to kick it over to you first to give us some just big picture framing comments. How did we get to this moment where the executive order is out? What is the administration trying to do here?
First, let me say, Emily and Sarah, thank you to CNAS and the Atlantic Council and to both of you for pulling this together, and obviously also for your report, which I think did shape some of the administration's thinking on this executive order. I think if you look back at the history here, you know, there's been a growing debate in Washington about U.S. investment in China going back really at least 5 years, at least to 2018, when Congress enacted CFIUS reform, known as FIRMA, and where there was a debate at that time about potentially including some targeted regulations on U.S. investments in China, as well as on Chinese investments here, but which was obviously ultimately not adopted at that time by the Congress. But I think that debate really kind of that discussion triggered an ongoing debate in Washington about where and how and whether certain U.S. investments in China might pose a risk to national security. At the very end of the Trump administration, the Trump administration began to take a step to regulate certain investments in particular Chinese companies. The Treasury Department launched something called the China Military Industrial Complex Sanctions Lists, which limits U.S. investment in the publicly traded securities of certain big Chinese companies that the government believes are linked to the military. And so the Trump administration began to develop a regime to go after particular companies in China, or investment in particular companies in China, where the administration or the U.S. government saw particular risks associated with investment in a particular company. I think when this administration, the Biden-Harris administration, came in, you know, they obviously were looking at a bunch of issues around China, U.S.-China policy, and looking at a number of potential gaps in the existing regime. And I think one of the gaps that the administration identified was a gap where U.S. investment might be helping Chinese companies get started or taken to scale in particular high technology sectors in China. So, you know, these aren't issues where you have a U.S. investor investing in a, you know, big public Chinese company, because you got another tool to address that, but where U.S. investors are helping, you know, Chinese startups in leading edge technologies really develop expertise and come to market and scale to market. And there wasn't really, under existing regulatory authority, an ability to control those kinds of investments. Obviously, if the U.S. investor was sending a widget to its company in China, you could control that under export controls. But where what they're doing is providing capital, where what they're doing is providing, you know, go-to-market expertise, those kinds of things, there really was no way to control those kinds of flows that I think this administration at least believed were potentially helping China in a couple of key technological areas. And I think that's really, that concern is really the genesis of the executive order that rolled out this week. Of course, there's a lot of debate on how to get there, scoping the definitions of some of these sectors, quite complicated, dealing with allies and partners can be quite complicated. But I think that gap, it was really that gap around the private investment and kind of early and mid-stage companies in high tech sectors in China, where you could control the flow of widgets, but not the flow of capital, was the genesis of what we saw come out this week.
Thank you, Peter. And I want to turn to Sarah next to talk about some of the broader debates that has been happening around the question of outbound investment flows more generally. You know, when we saw some of the early efforts from the Congress, for example, when they were developing their own approach on outbound investment, there were a lot of policy objectives that they were trying to wrap into their proposal. Now, obviously, that's different than where the administration landed. The administration landed on a kind of a tighter policy objective, as Peter just noted, about indigenous tech development. But just for kind of the broader context there, what are the other issues that were floating out there, and why do you think they didn't end up in this executive order?
Well, thanks, Emily, and thank you also to Peter and Eric for joining the stage. It's really been a pleasure to work with you all over the past couple of years. It's amazing to see what has occurred and the fact that this we finally have an outbound mechanism after, you know, a really long time of thinking it's just 2 or 3 weeks away is pretty amazing. So in terms of other areas that were considered or, and also to be fair, continue to be discussed, particularly on the Hill, are kind of concerns around offshoring and how that impacts jobs, critical supply chains. I think it's really important to remember the context of this EO and the discussions over outbound have taken place really like since COVID-19 and the aftermath of that. There are also concerns about human rights concerns and so forth. But at the top, Emily, you mentioned our policy brief that we co-authored last year. And in that report, we go through and talk through why those other potential policy goals are maybe not the right fit for an outbound mechanism. When it comes to issues around jobs and critical supply chains, the reasons why we don't have more of those kind of components of the supply chain in the US have to do with kind of commercial factors. And so therefore, just preventing US companies from offshoring production is not going to fix that problem. And so we were talking backstage about how it's really interesting and perhaps coincidental, but also important that I think at least that the EO came out on the 1 year anniversary of the Chips and Science Act. I think that different policies and legislation such as that and the IRA kind of get you further on those policy objectives. And also with human rights, it's a bit easier to deal with those concerns through list-based measures, since if you're worried about human rights abuses, there's more of a kind of clear documentation of that. And so that we already have capabilities around that. I'd also just like to quickly note that because this EO is narrowly focused on technology leakage and issues around indigenous development of military-related technology, this aligns the U.S.'s strategic posture on outbound regulations with those that are kind of maybe embraced is a little bit too strong of a term, but kind of recognized by partners and allies, both in documents such as the G7, the recent G7 communique on economic resilience and economic security, and also the recent European Commission's economic security strategy. And so I think that that will make outreach and coordination with partners easier, not easy, but at least easier.
Excellent. And, you know, there's been pushback from both sides on this executive order already, right? Some critics saying it didn't go far enough. We need to go, you know, harder, faster, stronger in terms of, you know, broader de-risking the investment relationship. So let's go to that part of the criticism first. And Eric, I'll turn to you for this. Obviously, you've been following conversations on the Hill really closely. We've seen some pretty pointed critiques come out already from certain, you know, Congress people about that this wasn't enough. What do you make of those critiques so far?
Yeah, thanks, Emily, and thanks to CNAS and the Atlantic Council as well, and good to be here with Peter and Sarah. You know, to back up a step, I think I would echo what Peter and Sarah said in the kind of the historic moment here. You know, this wasn't even thinkable a couple of years ago as Peter reviewed the history of pharma, you know, now 5 years ago. That the ideas fell off rather quickly and were deemed at the time just not possible. We weren't going to get there. And I think, you know, we should kind of reflect on that moment first and how we got here, both from the Trump administration, which deserves credit, as Peter said, for kind of placing kind of certain national security limits on U.S. investments in China at the center of their discussion. And then, you know, for the last several years of discussion that the Biden administration initiated, and really what I would call sort of a stretch goal that Jake Sullivan laid out in his speech 2 years ago. At the time, I don't think, you know, the interagency was there with that objective, but he kind of put that out there and said, you know, here's where we need to be. Knowing that Congress was a part of that conversation as well, and knowing that, you know, here in Washington, oftentimes, you know, to plant these kind of seeds, you have to see where they're going to grow and how this is going to become possible. So to get to this moment, you know, I think obviously the Chinese have helped, you know, that process. Congress has been a player in this discussion. You know, the last two administrations have got us there as well. But I think it really is a reflection on, you know, how our mental map here in Washington has shifted when it comes to China, and an expanded willingness to kind of focus on not just the easy things, allies and partners, defense spending, but financial flows and data flows and technology innovation and supply chain resilience. And so, you know, to come with that in mind, to come to your specific question, Emily, I think, you know, the pessimistic way to look at this is we spent a year, you know, kind of the administration spent a year briefing everyone, consulting, you know, on this process, really only to start a new consulting clock here. And it's likely another year before the final rule in this process even comes out. That's kind of the pessimistic take, right? The administration is probably too insistent on how narrow this action was over the last couple of days. So to the casual observer, you know, it's hard to understand how impactful this would be when even its own authors are insisting, you know, their intent was for it to be really tailored, really narrow, you know, and framed in a way even to reassure Beijing that it wouldn't go that far. And of course, other sectors were dropped. So that's, I think that's the pessimistic take. But to come to the optimistic take, and that's probably where I am personally, you know, I think there's a baseball analogy to be had here, as there is in any good, you know, foreign policy discussion. You know, the leadoff batter isn't going to hit a grand slam, right? Maybe they can get a solid single or double. And so if you think of it in those ways, I think that's where we are. We saw a good single or double hit the other day after a lot of discussion. And the coming year and this rulemaking process and all the lobbying that's likely to happen as a part of this is going to decide if that's a single or a double. But it's really going to be over to Congress now, you know, as the next batter at the plate, to extend this analogy further, to advance the runners, to figure out if, you know, we can really turn this into a couple of runs for the home team, you know, being here in Washington. And, you know, to wrap up, I think, you know, the other analogy we should compare this to is how CFIUS emerged. You know, it didn't happen overnight in some perfect form that everyone was happy with. It's obviously been decades of formation. It started with an executive order in the mid-70s. And then Congress, unhappy with the results by the mid-80s, you know, had another conversation about legislating and building on that and putting it into law and creating other mechanisms for blocking certain investments. I don't think this is going to take 10 or 15 years. Obviously, we're going to talk more about that and where Congress comes in. But I do think that this is a good, you know, first kind of single or double, and Congress has a chance, like with CFIUS this year, to take a few more swings and kind of build on that process. And I think that's how good lasting policy in Washington works and becomes lasting, of course, because, you know, it's iterative, and the executive and the Congress are working together on that process.
Let's talk about criticism from another quarter as well. You know, we've heard certainly from some maybe classical economists that, you know, this whole endeavor is ridiculous, right? Because China has access to plenty of capital, including other sources of foreign capital. You know, they have their own domestic sources of capital. They don't need the U.S. capital. And so by putting restrictions in, like, this is kind of, you know, a futile exercise. Now, I personally think that that's kind of missing the point a bit. It's confusing kind of macro flows with what I think the administration is trying to do, which are addressing very micro problems with specific types of transactions. But Peter, maybe I'll go to you for that question. You know, where do you think that criticism is coming from, and what do you make of it?
Yeah, no, and I appreciate the question. I guess, you know, one response, which I'll have to include, because I see that we have also have a question from Dimitri at the FT. I actually think the FT found a great example of impact this thing's already happening in their coverage out of China just yesterday, you know, where there was an anonymous Chinese semiconductor executive who told the FT he was looking at moving at least part of his operations offshore because he just thought capital's going to dry up for semiconductor investments in China. With this. And I think that is actually the impact that we are expecting to see. It's true that at kind of a macro level, China has plenty of capital. But what China doesn't really have is the deep expertise to deploy that capital in ways that help, you know, potentially innovative young startups or sort of mid-stage companies go to market and come to scale. And so I think you are going to see a real shift as some of the global early stage investors in high tech companies that just, you know, are very good at bringing companies to scale, find that for these, you know, kind of select high-end technologies in China, they're just going to have to look elsewhere. So I think we are going to see some real impact on the intended target of this executive order. Now, as you know, Eric says, and as you know, others have said, and Sarah, as you have said, there's sort of a broader debate about whether the target the administration is aiming at is correct. And there are, you know, arguments here in Washington, well, we should try to cut off, you know, all American investment in publicly traded securities in China and things like that. And I think that is where the administration at least has some sympathy to this economic argument of, well, if you're talking about a publicly traded security of a kind of generic Chinese firm, you know, if a U.S. investor isn't in it, you know, Swiss or, you know, Chinese, like that kind of capital is fungible. So I think what you're going to see here is an argument, or, you know, the kind of early stage VC capital is actually just not as fungible as some of that classical economic analysis would theorize it is.
Now let's start getting into some of the weeds here. I know we've all spent the last, 36 hours furiously reading the text of the executive order. And it is, you know, there were some very careful scoping decisions in there. The definitions matter. And clearly the Treasury Department is looking for input. But to kick us off, Sarah, what are the highlights that you're taking away from the scoping decisions? If folks know, you know, three things about how this thing works, like what do they need to know?
Okay, well, I'm going to give five. Sorry, I couldn't get it down to three. So the first is, I think most people know this by now, but it bears repeating. This is a prohibition and notification regime, not a case-by-case review. Mm-hmm. So it is not a reverse CFIUS, and also it is not retroactive. Right? So that's one. Two is it is focused on non-passive investment, direct or indirect, made through M&A, venture capital, private equity, greenfield, JV, convertible debt. So it's not going to apply to passive investment. There are some ways in which the administration is considering carving out some of those kinds of, or some investments. For instance, there are carve-outs such as university-to-university exchanges, which as a university professor, I highlighted immediately. But also, it's not going to apply to licensing arrangements. There's a potential carve-out for intra-firm transfers for U.S. businesses with subsidiaries in countries of concern. So that's just to say, you know, I don't want to get too in the weeds, but there's still some discussions around how we're going to carve out certain things. And depending on those carve-outs, those could really be pretty big deals or pretty narrow. So the third is it will cover investments when they are made into entities that are owned by a covered foreign person, which in the context of this means China, Hong Kong, and Macau. Fourth is it's going to apply only when those foreign covered persons are involved in covered national security technologies and products. We can get into the weeds about what's prohibited and what's notifiable, but these are broadly in semiconductors, quantum, and certain types of AI. And then finally, as was already mentioned by both Peter and Eric, that this is not the end of the process, but yet another restart on more discussions. So the EO authorized Treasury to develop an advance notice of public rulemaking, which was already released. And so there's 45 days to comment, and then the regulations will be drafted. So nothing has changed yet.
Mm-hmm. So we've got a couple of questions coming in from the audience that maybe we'll start to sprinkle in here, because I think some of them touch on, you know, a couple of examples of investments that are already happening, or you know, it's kind of interesting to think through how the EO might impact these. So we've got a question from Sabine. What about Micron's decision to invest freshly in China, despite of China's decision to ban the sale of certain chips to certain Chinese institutions? So I think talking about the listing of, or the investigation into Micron, which potentially was in retaliation for some of the US export controls, but they're making decisions to invest. Also a question from Ruth about Intel's current involvement in China's semiconductor knowledge buildup. So obviously two examples in the chip sector where there's been some existing investments, potentially would be future investment. How do we think that the EO will impact those sorts of cases? And Sarah, maybe I'll go to you on that one.
Sure. I'd also love to hear what others on the call think about this, because some of this is a little bit complicated. But I'd first start by saying that, as I mentioned, this will not be a retroactive rule. However, the advance notice mentioned that they may be asking for information about transactions that would have been covered if they were made after the implementation of the rules, if they're made in this interim period, just to get a better sense of what's happening and how they might want to scope the rules. In terms of how this would affect these kinds of investments if they were made after the rule comes into effect, some of this will depend on how such investments are scoped, how they're structured, as well as what the carve-outs look like. Because if there is a pretty broad carve-out in terms of inter-firm transfers for subsidiaries that are already in operation in China, then this might not touch them, very much. But if that carve out is much narrower, then it would. But I'm curious to see what Peter and Eric might have to say about this, if you have thoughts.
Yeah, why don't we kick it over to Peter, if you have thoughts on those questions, and also any of your kind of big picture reactions about, what surprised you in the executive order? Was there anything you weren't expecting? Or anything that you think was notable that hasn't gotten enough attention yet?
Well, I'll start at the with your sort of broader big picture comment, Emily, which is, I think the administration had been signaling for many months that they were going to do something that was narrow and targeted. And I think they basically did what they said they were going to do, which is something that is pretty narrow and targeted. That said, I think there were actually a couple of ways in which this might have been even, although I think it was pretty much exactly what they said they'd been doing, there are a couple of ways in which I think it was probably even a tad broader than certain folks might have expected. For example, we see a pretty robust prohibition in the quantum sector, right? It's not only prohibitions in the high-end semiconductor sector. And, I think on the notification side of semiconductors, although the prohibitions in semiconductors are fairly narrowly targeted to try to track the current export controls, on the notification side, it looks to me like you're basically not going to be able to invest in the semiconductor sector in China, except maybe in publicly traded securities, without notifying the U.S. government about what you're doing. So I think there are actually certain ways in which this is a little bit broader than some folks had thought. Just one point to follow up on what Sarah made. I do think it is the intent of the administration, where you have an American company that already has a subsidiary or partner in China. I think it is kind of their conceptual intent to not require notification or any prohibition on what would be sort of routine ongoing business activities. But I do think they intend to require notification and or prohibit what they would view as a new capital investment in that subsidiary. So I think that's the line they're trying to draw with some of this language around, they'd allow a kind of some money to flow to a subsidiary in China where it's sort of for operations. But I think that this is not going to create some sort of an exception where a company can U.S. company can sort of massively plus up. The final point I wanted to make, and I think this is really important, is there was a lot of, I think some people saw this before the executive order came out as principally affecting venture capital funds and kind of financial investors. I actually think one of the biggest impacts from this executive order is going to be on operating U.S. high-tech companies, whether they're semiconductor, AI, or quantum, who are looking at making operating investments in China. which is squarely under the purview of the executive order. And I think in some ways, maybe a bigger impact going forward than some of the VC guys out there.
Just to jump in, Emily, I agree with all that. I think two items here. One, on your later question about what surprised us in there. I mean, I think it's important to know too, after a lot of debate about reverse CFIUS screening, you know, versus prohibition notification, I think there is now clear consensus, you know, not just in the EO, but even Congressman Gallagher, Chairman Gallagher's letter to President Biden last week on scoping this, where he talked about, you know, a more predictable approach that, you know, avoids onerous case-by-case screening. I think a year ago, 2 years ago, especially in the congressional process, there was a strong debate over that. And that's largely been answered. And we should, you know, at least recognize that. As well, you know, these two questions that we were raised about the semiconductor industry, to me, that reminds me of just how much the semiconductor industry is sort of at the core of all this and, you know, both promote and protect agenda, as was said by Sarah, you know, on the anniversary of the CHIPS Act, you know, which was, you know, the principal promote agenda.
Eric, we might have lost your audio there. Well, why don't we keep going for the time being and give Eric time to collect his brilliant thoughts on this.
Can I just add one thing? Kind of, I think, Peter, that's that kind of distinction about what the intent of the administration is a really important point. What I will say is that I do have questions about monitoring and enforcement, because I do think that it will be a little bit more complicated than maybe some people give it credit in terms of determining, well, what type of intercompany transfer is really just for status quo versus what is for a real capital investment, especially when we start to think about kind of, well, is this money going towards just maintaining a current piece of equipment or upgrading a piece of equipment as equipment needs to be replaced? Will that be considered status quo or not? So I do think that there are kind of some questions about how this actually works in practice.
Perhaps this is a good time to ask the really nerdy question that we were talking about backstage, which is about this revenue-related rule that got some press from, I think, those of us who read the Bloomberg article. There's a question about whether there is a potential loophole that may have been inadvertently or intentionally kind of baked into the rule in terms of, you know, investments that are made into larger Chinese conglomerates or tech companies that might not be captured if it's really their subsidiaries that are engaging in the AI chips or quantum activities of concern, and whether there might be kind of a loophole for investments to kind of go into that parent and somehow flow down. It seems like that's perhaps not the intent of what the rule is intending to do. Clearly an area where further clarity, examples, FAQs from the Treasury Department would be greatly appreciated. But Sarah, Peter, what do you think about the intent? What were they trying to do there?
In the advance notice, I mean, they specify the intent, which is that it is intended to capture parent companies whose subsidiaries and branches engage in activities related to a covered national security technology or product. So clearly the idea is that this is going to, that they're trying to capture more transactions rather than less, right? And so I understand kind of the concern about, does this create a loophole? And of course, it will all be down to how this actually is implemented and what the final definitions end up being. But I think that understanding plus the fact that indirect transactions are covered, as well as the knowledge rule that talks about how if you know that this, or you should know that this investment is going to be used to further activities in covered national security technologies or products, I think that suggests that this is maybe is a loophole that is actually kind of closed off. I agree with you that I think that when the final rules come out, it would be very helpful to have a lot of illustrative hypothetical examples to help firms understand and investors understand their notification requirements and prohibitions, because of course they're on the first line of enforcement, of voluntary enforcement of the rule.
Okay. Thank you, Sarah, for diving into the weeds there for us. I think we might have Eric back, so I'm going to let him finish his thought, and then curious his thoughts as well, you know, about perhaps some of the specific parts of the rule and how the rule was constructed that might be leading to some criticism that it got watered down. So, Eric, over back to you, hopefully.
Yeah, no, sorry about that. Yeah, 3 years of COVID and still can't do it right. I was going to say, you know, with the heavy focus on semiconductors and those questions reflective of that, you know, how does this apply? You know, it's just a reminder of all the other sectors that weren't covered and been discussed. You know, IO obviously being one that fell off relatively early, according to reporting, you know, and is also not one being considered by Congress. Large, you know, capacity batteries is another that Congress originally had in some of their legislation have fallen off, including in what the final Cornyn Casey version. Critical minerals, you know, and the list kind of goes on. And I think that's sort of a gap to your question of, you know, where it was watered down, to use that term, or where there's still work to be done, or where there's disagreement, both in Congress and in the interagency over what sectors are national security, are critical national security. And I think that's a discussion we're going to have in this fall as part of the conference process of Cornyn Casey. Is it just scoped more narrowly to these sectors, or you know, should we look more broadly? And that might not get fully resolved this year, to my CFIUS analogy, but I think it's a debate and a conversation that will still be with us, you know, the next couple of years.
We've got a question from an audience member named Emily saying, some foreign partners have expressed concern about the potential extraterritorial authority that this would afford the U.S. government. Is this a valid concern? How can the U.S. government enforce these rules without a strong extraterritorial tool? And I'll just, of course, add a little bit of color on that, which is that in the October 7th export controls rules, there was a good deal of extraterritoriality that was included in that set of regulations. I don't think we're seeing quite the same level of that here. And I think there's an intent to not inadvertently capture foreign investors. But certainly an area that we'll want to keep an eye on. Maybe, Peter, why don't I kick it to you to get your thoughts on that question?
Yeah, let me maybe begin by stepping back a little bit and say, I think that the kind of allied and partner element of this has been important to the administration for more than a year now. And I think you've seen over the last 6 or 7 months, the administration work hard to kind of get allies and partners at least on board with the conceptual problem here. You know, we've seen statements out of European Union President von der Leyen and included in the EU's recent sort of strategy on China that the EU will look at outbound investments. And actually the Koreans and the Taiwanese already have certain restrictions on outbound investments in Chinese semiconductors. So I think you've really seen a focus from the administration on let's get our allies and partners on board to encourage them over the next 6, 12, 18 months to join with us in enacting their own regulations rather than trying to take a heavy extraterritorial approach on that. That said, I do think you see a couple of things in the ANPRM where the administration is trying to make sure that it that there aren't sort of glaring loopholes, right? So you do clearly see some effort in the ANPRM to regulate what the non-American subsidiaries of U.S. subsidiaries do so that you don't have a situation where, you know, a U.S. firm can't make the investment, but it's, you know, European or Bahamian or whatever subsidiary can. So I think they've put a little bit on that might look in some way a little extraterritorial, but I don't think from an American perspective that is extraterritorial. It's really just trying to make sure there aren't some glaring loopholes here. U.S. very much wants the rest of the world to come with us, but they're working diplomatically to do that.
I've got another good question from the audience here from HK Park about intangible benefits that VCs provide, noting that there's no proposed restriction on outbound know-how. Is the assumption that outbound investment is a proxy for VCs' desire to provide know-how? You know, I think this touches on one of the debates that has come up a bunch in this conversation, which is how are we thinking about what is an intangible benefit? What is that piece of the capital flow that we care about that isn't already covered in export controls, that isn't already covered under existing regimes? Like, what's that gap? And how do we talk precisely about that gap that we're really trying to capture here. It's not purely passive flows. It's not widgets, as Peter mentioned earlier. What's that intangible thing that we care about, and how is that different than what's already covered? Peter, do you want to amplify on that? Because you touched on this earlier in your comments.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think that this is an element, one reason and one area where I'm quite sympathetic to the administration of, if you want to regulate the U.S.-China economic relationship, and this is a piece of it, you kind of have to start somewhere and figure out what's working and what isn't working and how to build from there over time. And I think, you know, as we discussed earlier, the administration has a view that what they are trying to regulate, because in some sense, capital is fungible, you know, pure capital is fungible. What they're trying to regulate is this kind of go-to-market management and other process expertise that U.S. investors tend to bring when they invest in an earlier mid-stage company. You know, I think there is a conceptual argument, well, if you're worried about those intangible benefits, shouldn't you also be worried about, you know, McKinsey business consulting services or audit services or, you know, all these other things? And I think there is a conceptual argument to that. On the other hand, you can't kind of boil the ocean in the economic relationship and have a functioning economic relationship that does allow a lot of non-objectionable, non-concerning, and in ways mutually beneficial business to continue. And so I think what you see is the administration taking a view of, we see a problem with these investments and the intangibles that go along. Let's work at how to address that. But this is going to be an iterative process over a number of years. And as Eric says, it's very much not just the administration that's going to iterate on this. It's also Congress that's going to iterate on this going forward.
Yeah, and that's a good segue to talk about what's next on this, right? This is certainly just the start of the conversation. And Eric, maybe I'll ask you to come in on some of the pain points where we think industry might be pushing on this. You know, what do you think they're most concerned about? What do you think their reaction is going to be here? And then, of course, you know, we will definitely be watching Hill reactions. There's the NDAA amendment conversations, broader questions around whether there'll be a bigger pieces of legislation. How do you see this conversation unfolding, not just over the 45-day comment period, but really over the next year?
Yeah, I think on industry, you know, look for the next 45 days to be kind of a flurry of submissions, you know, and an effort to kind of shape the discussion, you know, in the next year. You mentioned, I think there's, you know, perhaps the delay, as Peter referred to, the last 6 months or so, give cause for more input, for more consultation. I think where things are now on this executive order in the congressional process to where they maybe were last winter with industry has come a long way. You didn't see the same sort of responses and statements from associations, you know, the last 2 days you may have saw last winter. This has been baked a lot more, is my point. And the same thing with the congressional approach and what we saw passed, you know, now 3-4 weeks ago. I think the other piece that, to get to one of the questions too, that we're going to see or need to watch for is what's China's reaction going to be, because I think this will shape industry reaction, this will shape congressional reaction. They're going to face this, you know, the Beijing's going to face this similar problem of, you know, do we respond now symbolically? Do we respond asymmetrically? Do we respond, you know, in a stronger way that only creates more antibodies and accelerates other actions that, you know, Beijing would rather not like to see? I think we should expect that, again, the narrowness of this approach probably means that they hold off in a larger response and try to use the process, you know, in the coming year to shape it. And then, you know, I think the other factor that needs to be considered here is this is half of what the administration obviously wanted to accomplish this summer. The other is the October 7 rule. If we're able to kind of accomplish this, which again, a month or two ago, there was a lot of speculation, will this even happen? Is it going to be pushed off? Obviously it's happened. I think the final rule, you know, as Sarah said earlier, it's 2 or 3 weeks away. You're never wrong with those assumptions. But if those two things cleared off the deck, you know, from an industry perspective, from a China perspective, another big question we should be asking, you know, in the forming of this event, like what happens now is, you know, what's the rest of the administration's agenda? What other issues do they turn to? And has that, you know, what are those other factors that, again, Beijing and companies in Congress will all be calculating? So to some degree, we're talking about this event, but also talking about this event now being somewhat in the rearview mirror and what comes next, and what is, you know, the opportunity cost been of so much focus on this issue the last year or so.
And of course, this is coming as well in the middle of the administration's attempts to revive more regular conversations with counterparts in China. We know this has been a topic of conversation. It will continue to be a topic of conversation. We've seen some initial Chinese reactions that were pretty critical. One might say they were pretty hypocritical given China's own outbound investment restrictions as well as their inbound investment restrictions. But nonetheless, it will be a point of contention in the relationship. And the administration will have kind of a challenge as they are, as you rightly noted, Eric. You know, this is not the last of the actions that they will take. You know, at least we'll see more export controls. And the challenge is, how can they continue to take the actions that they've been quite clear are necessary for U.S. national security interests while still trying to maintain those channels of communication, not for kind of, you know, broader, you know, wishy-washy engagement purposes, but because we need stability and predictability in one of the world's most consequential economic relationships, right? Like, that's a tough balancing act. That was more of a comment than a question, but maybe I'll ask Peter to come in and for his reactions on that dynamic.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sympathetic to the administration trying to, you know, as they keep talking about, stabilize and put some guardrails on this relationship. I actually have a little bit of a view that, you know, at this point, it is the geopolitics that is driving the relationship, and the economics are kind of derivative of and subsidiary to the geopolitics. And I think ultimately, if the administration wants to have a stable economic relationship, what they need to do is figure out how to have a stable geopolitical relationship, and then the economics will follow. Because, you know, I mean, what's unsettling the economic relationship? It's concerns about China's military activities. It's concern about, will China, you know, aggressively take Taiwan? And I think, and you know, it's concerns about, will China more actively support Russia? And I just think it's going to be, you know, practically speaking, quite hard to have the sort of stability in the economic relationship that the administration says it wants, unless they can figure out how to stabilize the geopolitical side of it.
Yeah, Sarah, why don't I ask you to come in on this as well? You know, obviously you've been thinking a lot about kind of the broader dynamics of the increasing, you know, kind of security related nature of the relationship. Also, you've spent a lot of time thinking about the dynamics with Europe. So welcome your thoughts on those broader geopolitical dynamics.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I agree with Peter that, you know, there are a lot, and Eric as well, that there's a lot on the table, right? And so it's important to not think about Chinese response as a kind of like in a vacuum siloed on only this one issue, but all of the other issues that are on the table, and also how to triage them, so to speak. If I were the Chinese, I would view this as a pretty positive sign, because the EO is much more narrow than many had kind of pressed, right? So the fact that it's so focused on just three technologies, the fact that it does not include passive investment, I see that as, you know, much more narrow than what it could have been. But I'm not in the Chinese government, so I can't. So just because I think that's how they should think about it doesn't mean that they necessarily will. But I will say, you know, Eric brought up the October 7th controls. And if I were triaging all of the kind of economic security measures, I would be much more focused on that. In particular, I'd be much more focused on trying to impose costs on the Japanese and the Dutch to try to break the coalition. And so I think if we're going to see much in the way of reactions, it's going to be on that side. With respect to European partners and allies, and especially the EU, you know, we do see that the Commission is very interested in tabling a plan on outbound, which I think is really surprising, because in my conversations in the past, like this is a even kind of swifter turnaround than maybe in the U.S. But I think that there continue to be some outstanding questions, because whenever we think about these issues with respect to the EU, we need to think about who has the authority, or in the EU context, it's called competence. So who has competence over what? If anything is related to the economy, it's at the level of the EU. But if anything is related to national security, it's at the level of the member states. And so if the member states really want to keep any outbound regulations to a national security frame, it's going to devolve to the member states, and it's going to require each member state to develop their own mechanism. And we see that, you know, the EU member states are still working to set up their inbound regimes. So I think that, you know, it took a long time for the US to get here, and I imagine that it's going to take a long time for partners and allies to figure out their own mechanisms as well.
Yeah. Eric, do you have thoughts on that? And particularly maybe chiming in on the engagement and diplomacy with Asian partners as well. We've got a question in the chat about whether we think other chip alliance countries like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan will follow suit. Obviously, you know, some of them already have some sort of mechanism. But I guess it's a question specifically related to the outbound, but also the broader economic security cooperation with our Asian partners. And then any additional thoughts you might have on the Chinese reactions piece as well.
Yeah, on the allies and partners piece, you know, I think we saw a pretty successful roadmap with October 7th and how that, you know, unilateralism sometimes begets multilateralism, and the trilateral effort that came out of it to show that we were, you know, before we were in a position, I think, to work with the Japanese and the Dutch on this. And similarly, that's what happened with FIRMA 5 years ago. You know, once the law was passed, once the U.S. had taken that initiative step, others were either woken up the issue or more serious about kind of, you know, moving the ball down the field as well. I think, you know, Peter mentioned the EU and Sarah mentioned it as well, the G7 statement in May on this topic. You know, there is a good discussion. Obviously, some of our East Asian allies and partners already have developed these mechanisms. I think now that we've taken this step, you know, how can we capitalize, and like with October 7th, and what are the countries that we want to target most to kind of develop these regimes and move forward in the same way. There's an opportunity next week with the trilateral, the Japanese and the Koreans. You know, we should look for some sort of comment on this, maybe in that joint statement about the need for this type of mechanism as well. And then seven ministers and many other opportunities in the fall. So I think now that this is, you know, been the seed's been planted, you know, the administration can focus on the multilateral piece as it does its rulemaking process. A couple of thoughts on Congress, but let's come to that, you know, as we close. So.
Sure. You know, one thing we haven't actually dug into yet is the question of, you know, how the EO is treating AI, you know, to go back into the weeds for a second. But I do think this is important, so I want to make sure we talk about it. You know, this is not the first time that the administration has tried to get its arms around, you know, the right way to define for the purposes of regulation what constitutes artificial intelligence that's important for national security reasons. It's admittedly a really difficult question. This is an inherently dual-use technology, not clear exactly what the like exact military applications of some of these new large language models will be. But nonetheless, you know, growing sense that this is really important and we need to figure out a way to get our arms around this besides just controlling the chips component of AI, which has been the default so far. It doesn't seem like there's a very clear vision in the executive order for how to do this, besides linking it to specific end uses. And maybe that is the right approach, but it is different than what we're seeing in the approach on chips, which is much more about, you know, drawing a line based on specific technical specifications. You know, again, it's a hard question, easy to throw darts from the outside on this one. But I do think that's going to be an area where there should be a lot of focus in the rulemaking. Maybe I'll ask Peter if he's got any kind of reactions to that and kind of why the administration may have landed there on the AI piece specifically, and then we'll wrap up.
Yeah, just to agree with you, I think this is one of the most complicated sort of technical and definitional issues in the executive order. And it's one that I think, as the ANPRM makes clear, they'd really welcome some comment on. You know, as you say, I think it's quite hard technically because so much of AI is general purpose, and they worry. I think the administration is trying to draw a line of they don't want to just sort of require notification of, you know, every sort of, you know, low-end AI that is out there, you know, hotel customer service chatbots and things like that. On the other hand, as we've seen over the last 7 or 8 months, some kind of chatbots can be quite interesting and maybe have dual use applications, right? Mm-hmm. And so, as you say, the conceptual line they have tried to draw is to have a pretty broad definition of what AI is, but then both for notification purposes, and they're also contemplating a very narrow prohibition here. The notification, and if they do it, prohibition would only apply to AI that is kind of either exclusively or primarily intended to be used for certain identified purposes, such as, you know, military applications, surveillance, and these kind of things. And I think conceptually, this is, you know, I think there's an intuitive conceptual appeal to this kind of an approach. I actually think when you talk to folks in industry, this is going to be harder to implement in a meaningful way than it is conceptually to talk about it. I think it's going to be one of the things that they're going to kind of most be deliberating over as they deal with comments. It is also obviously also sort of overlap. I mean, it's an overlap isn't the right word. It is a parallel effort with the semiconductor controls, because there is an idea that you can kind of, with the semiconductor controls, restrict China from developing higher end AI generally via the semiconductor vector. And so this is in some sense like a complementary vector to the semiconductor vector.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I'll happily give a plug here for some of the work that the CNAS artificial intelligence team is doing on these issues, trying to see if we can help move the debate along on some of these admittedly really, really hard policy questions, making sure that the intent does in fact match what industry thinks makes sense and they know how to implement. Why don't I give everyone just a couple of minutes for their closing thoughts. Anything that we missed, any big picture comments that you want to make sure folks take away? We'll go to Eric first, and then Sarah, and then we'll let Peter have the last word. Eric.
Yeah, thanks. And thanks for doing this on short notice. I think I'll just reserve the last minute or two here to talk about Congress and the next steps. I think we talked a lot about Cornyn Casey and as a parallel to this effort, I think it's a good chance to remind everyone of the letter that Senator Schumer and Pelosi sent last fall on this topic, which was quite unprecedented. It was the Congress essentially telling the executive to take action because we can't. And that's exactly what's happened here. A year ago, it didn't look like legislative opportunities were possible. It's, you know, the House effort sort of died in the USICA negotiations. But here we are with a version of Cornyn Casey that's finally passed in the NDAA. It's going to be conference this fall. And I think the dynamic has changed a lot in the last 36 hours. The chairman of the Financial Services Committee, McCrary, has been largely opposed to and vocally opposed to the White House efforts up until this point, put out a yesterday endorsing it, which to me is important because it sets a floor on the Cornyn Casey negotiation. It says that even, you know, McHenry and others who've been opposed or had different views of how to approach this are willing to kind of endorse this and set a floor for where it should go. I think the two questions that need to be answered now is, does Congress include a prohibition? Right now, it's largely a notification. Obviously, that's different from the executive order. And if they don't, you know, that leads to challenges in this process in the executive. And, you know, does Treasury implement the EO if Congress doesn't include prohibition in a legislative effort that, you know, is actually finalized in the NDAA by the end of the year? That's a big question. And do they go any further in other sectors? You know, we talked about bio, we talked about large scale batteries. I have to say right now, I don't think so. Some of those opt out, even in the Senate version that passed overwhelmingly, but those are two areas I think we need to watch for that'll be important as this conference process happens, you know, this fall. And you know, many House Republicans who were, I think, were critical in the last couple of days of this effort, you know, actually have to sort of step up and you know, lead of what I think is a divided House and even some division within Republicans in the House, as well as the Senate on this issue to actually, you know, lock it into that executive congressional kind of CFIUS-like historical approach that I spoke about as we started today. So thanks again.
Thank you, Eric. Sarah, over to you.
Sure. I'll just make two quick points, but thank you, Emily, for and your whole team for arranging this. So just to add on to what Eric mentioned, the other thing that I will be watching for with respect to Congress is if the Casey Cornyn amendment makes it through in the Conference NDAA, I'd also be curious to see if passive investment notifications stay or if they drop out. I think that's important. And I do think that there are some concerns about the ways that people are talking about a passive investment notification that clearly are about kind of trying to exact broader economic damage on the China market, which I think is quite escalatory. The other thing, just in terms of kind of a broader, how are we going to, evaluate this moving forward? Of course, I'm going to set aside the fact that I've already made it clear that I think that the devil is in the details, and I really want to see a robust comment period and what happens in terms of how the definitions shake out. But in terms of how to think about the effects, I will be looking at how this affects our innovation economy rather than being focused on what it does in terms of kind of deal flow or investment dollars. I want to know, does this help? Does this make sure, or when we enact this, what happens to whether the US and US firms remain at the center or the edge of the innovation frontier? And I think for me, that is kind of the key metric here, is making sure that what we're doing is not inadvertently making it harder for us to be at that edge. So that's what I'll be looking for in the future.
Okay, last word is yours, Peter.
I think Eric commented and Sarah commented a lot over what we're going to see over the next couple of months. And so I'll leave that there. I just would make the bigger point, which I think it is very clear from their comments and everyone's expectation, kind of regardless of what happens with Congress over the next couple of months and with the administration as they, put out a final rule early next year, Q1, whatever the timeline is, this is just the start. Right. I think anyone who thinks that 5 years from now there won't be this plus something else is just terribly misguided, because I think it's just very clear that we might not be able to predict exactly, how the ladder is going to go. And I don't think we can predict the end point of the ladder necessarily, because geopolitics will drive that. But I think that this is we do have to understand that this is a start of what's going to be an iterative process. It's going to go on for a number of years in terms of regulating the U.S.-China investment relationship.
Excellent. Well, thank you, Peter. Thank you, Eric. Thank you, Sarah. This was a fantastic conversation. What a fun and informative way to spend a summer Friday morning. So again, I appreciate you making the time in the midst of a very, very busy time. Thank you to our audience for joining and for the great questions. We are looking forward to more conversations about this issue, putting out more analysis from CNAS, and I'm sure the Atlantic Council as well. So stay tuned for that. And last but not least, of course, a big thank you to our CNAS communications team for pulling this event off at very quick notice. Thank you all.
Thank you for listening to this episode of CNAS Live, a production of the Center for a New American Security. This episode was produced by Anna Peterson and Charles Horn, with design help from Melody Cook and Ren Rothback. Please rate and subscribe from wherever you get your podcasts.